Loving planes? Want to be a pilot? Or just enjoying a good old pod? You are at the good place. Welcome to the 9Gs podcast, an aviation podcast.
Hey, thank you, Andrew. Thank you very much for joining me on the show.
My pleasure. It's great to be back again. And I'm trying to remember actually when it was that we last spoke, because it might have been during COVID.
You know what? I've did a little bit of research, and to be honest, I think it was in episode 18 of the first season. I think it was released on the 1st of February 2021.
Wow.
And kind of a long time ago, because we know that we had kind of a crazy pandemic that was in place at that moment and was not very delightful for everybody. And yeah, we talked a lot about it. So for the listeners that just joined us, I will remind you that Andrew is a Boeing 787 pilot flying for a major UK airline. He was a former military pilot. He flew for the Royal Navy, the Harrier, and he flew also for, I think it was Thomas Cook, right?
Thomas Cook, that's right.
Yeah, you flew Airbus, a little bit of Airbus, hopefully,
I did.
For Thomas Cook. And right now you're still flying the 787 for a major carrier in the UK.
Exactly that, exactly. And you know what? When we last recorded that interview, I came back from a work trip and ended up in hospital with COVID. Who'd have thought that? You never would have thought this sort of thing would get to you. But 2 months after we made that recording, when you said February 21, I was in hospital for 2.5 weeks with COVID-19.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, isn't it crazy? It's a weird, wasn't that a weird, weird time? But it's great to be back again. And thanks very much for the intro.
Yeah, it was due to COVID, right?
It was, yeah. I was one of the original, all these different variants that came out. So I was one of the original Delta variants, and I came back from a trip to Delhi, and ended up really quite unwell. Lost about 2 stone in weight. It's about, God, I don't know how many kilos that is, like 15 kilos in weight, and on oxygen and all sorts of problems. Yeah, what a crazy time. But I'm alive and I'm well.
Hopefully you're good now.
Yeah,
it was kind of crazy. So you think you catch the COVID back in India?
I think, almost certainly. Yeah. And terrible times, you know. I remember being in hospital and the scenes in India as well, you know, and thinking, my goodness, I was so lucky to be back home and have such good medical care, because in India, you know, it's a really tough time for people over there. Very distressing to see that. But anyway, we're out the back of it now, so hopefully we'll never see anything like that again. And aviation has recovered, which is the main thing as well, because it was a pretty dire time. And I think you went back to flying Rafale, if you're still doing that, Mathieu.
No, I'm not. I transitioned again from the military to civilian aviation in 2023, in the middle of 2023. And that's why I wanted to have a talk with you, because I think we have to talk about that, because transitioning from a military career to a civilian career is not very, very easy, especially in aviation, because obviously you don't know how to sell yourself. You don't know how to have a resume, because most of us were in the forces for something like 10, 15, 20 years, and we never did a proper resume because we were hired pretty young. So yeah, it's kind of I think it's worth talking about it, because it's not very easy for us to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember when I left the armed forces, I went to my very first airline selection process, which I failed. I actually failed at a testing stage, which was verbal reasoning. I don't know if you've seen these tests where you have to read through a passage of text and then answer true, false, or cannot say. And I remember going through this test and thinking, you know, what the hell is this test? And then being told I'd not passed it and that I wouldn't be progressing that day to the interview stage. And I remember going and speaking to the interviewer and saying, well, look, you know, I was pretty down to earth, I'd have to say, even for a Harrier pilot, I was quite down to earth. But I remember saying, you know, surely you'll interview me with my experience. And no, they weren't interested. And you know what? You forward wind now, you know, in the last few months, I've had military pilots that have come to my business for some help, having been unsuccessful with airline application or assessment processes, even, you know, at the final stage, F-35 pilots failing the simulator assessment, for example. So there's definitely a new skill set to learn and a new way of doing things. And I think that transition, you know, although all of the qualities that military pilots have, both technical in terms of their flying expertise, but more importantly, as you'll know, the non-technical elements, they need a little bit of refining, a little bit of knowledge to help these pilots put their best foot forward and not do what I did really and fail that first assessment. And that's what I specialize in. So we can definitely get stuck into some top tips for people looking to transition from the military into the airlines.
Yeah, so back in the days when you failed this first interview, how did you prepare yourself?
Well, this was the thing. I sort of thought I knew how I was preparing for an interview. I thought that bearing in mind I didn't get to the interview stage. It was the tests, these reasoning tests, and I hadn't done any preparation. I didn't even know that they were going to be part of this process. I thought it was going to be a bit of an informal chat with some pilots and, you know, and if they liked me, I'd get a job. But of course, that isn't the case. And definitely, and this is going back, you know, 17 years now. And definitely that's not the case now. And what I see through Flight Deck Wingman is most candidates are hideously underprepared for applications and assessment processes. And in fact, the statistics here in the UK is roughly 10%, maybe maximum 20% of candidates are successful from a job opening to receiving a job offer, which means that 80 to 90% are unsuccessful, which is quite a big percentage, you know, that are unsuccessful. But what I've been able to do with Flight Deck Wingman is take that success rate for the stages that we prepare people for to over 90%. And that's through what we call competency-based training methods. So I'd be happy to chat as much as you want to about those sorts of training methods and give some sort of free advice here on the pod.
Yeah, no problem. The unofficial statistics about military pilots, especially the French Air Force, I don't know about the French Navy, but transitioning to the civilian aviation and trying to proceed to Air France, that is, you know, the major career in France and the goal that everybody wants to achieve. The unofficial percentage is something like between 25 to 30% of success. And when you think about it, I mean, initially, when you're not in the forces and you think about, you know, a military pilot wanted to go to an airline, and especially a major airline like Air France, you just say that, okay, it's going to be, I think it's going to be pretty easy for them to success. And when you have a look about it, you realize that it's not the case. It's not the case at all. 25 to 30% is pretty low in my understanding, because I think that it could be higher with great preparation.
Yeah, definitely. And a slightly better percentage rate there with Air France, for example, than we've got here in the UK with the big sort of flag carriers. But that's only my estimated statistics. So I guess you need to dial into why that might be. And I think there's a number of reasons. There's either a lack of preparation, so people just don't prepare at all or not enough. But more likely, it's a lack of effective preparation. So if you don't know how to prepare and you don't know how you're being assessed, how can you possibly provide the recruitment teams with the information and the skills and qualities that they're looking for if you don't know what they are and you don't know how to provide them to them? So what we're able to do and what military pilots generally need some guidance with is how to make their skill set transferable into language that and behaviors that the airlines will recognize. And that, you know, doesn't take a long time. You know, military pilots are smart people. You know, they pick things up very, very quickly. And you and I both know the standards that have to be achieved to get to the front line of any military type, whether it's fast jet, rotary, or multi-engine. So they're all very capable people. But yeah, a lack of effective preparation and not knowing how you're assessed is probably accounting for the majority not being successful. So yeah, it's important to understand that.
Yeah, I think you can add the fear too, because as I said initially, you've been in the forces for 15 to 20 years and you never wrote a resume, obviously, and you never went for an interview, obviously. And you just have to realize that the people in front of you, they can be psychologists or they can be fellow pilots. They have a task and they just want something is to recruit you. and you have to try to please them and try, you have to try to fall in the boxes that they want to tick. And yeah, it's just a matter of, I think, trust. You have to trust yourself and you have to be sure that you have the skills that they want. Even if you don't know how to, as you said, how to translate those skills, because as military pilots, we have our own language. You know, we have our own things, our own way to do things, but it's a very, to me, it's very valuable to the civilian world. And knowing that the people in front of you want to recruit you, that you have the skills, but you have to introduce those skills to those people.
Yeah, definitely. And what, in my experience, most people's preparation for assessments is reliant upon previous feedback from other candidates. So whether it's their friends that have been through the process recently, or whether it's online forums or some other material that's produced that says, hey, here's the, you know, for example, the Air France interview questions, but and here's a group assessment task that was asked, and people base their preparation on this inside information. And in my opinion, there's no advantages to doing that, but there's a lot of disadvantages. So, for example, for the interview phase, candidates will often rehearse interview answers. And the downsides of that are that they sound rehearsed, or they deliver their rehearsed answer and they don't answer the question that they were asked, or they don't know how to answer the question at all, or they end up in what I call an interview loop and they're just rambling. Whereas if you are able to understand when you're asked a question, and this is just for the interview phase, what competencies, so what skills or qualities are the recruiters really trying to discover about you when they ask that question? And you go, well, that's pretty obvious. You know, let's take the example. Why do you want to join Air France? What I would really want to hear in my head as a candidate is, you know, hi, Andrew, we're looking for evidence of your motivation competency, please. And that's a very basic example. But if you can take that to other stages of the interview process, and they're asking you about times when you've done things, or maybe they put you in a false scenario and they're asking you how you might resolve that, having that understanding of the competencies, which are what I sort of term as areas of strength, things like communication or motivation or leadership and teamwork, having an understanding of what they're looking for and then how to provide them with these little bits of proof, these pointers that give them that warm and fuzzy feeling that you do have strength in those areas they're assessing. But doing that is a skill. And like all of us, you know, we don't go through interviews very often. And nerves get the better of you. And if you get a question you weren't expecting and then you don't know how to answer it because you've not rehearsed an answer, it's not going to go well for you. So it's much better to go into a recruitment journey knowing what competencies are being assessed, hearing that coming from the recruiters indirectly. I actually call this the interview language translator. So your ability to hear a question and understand what skills and competencies are being assessed, and then being able to provide this proof, this evidence that you have strength in those areas. And candidates that are successful are the ones that do that, and the candidates that are unsuccessful don't. And that translates into the group assessment phases as well, and the simulator assessment. And I'm sure that you're also trained by the IATA pilot competencies in the flight deck, things like workload management, situational awareness, communication, leadership and teamwork, etc. And what many pilots think, in, again, in the aircraft is, well, if I know what the profile was that the simulator assessment asked and I fly that profile with somebody, then I'll pass a simulator assessment. But what if that profile doesn't occur? And what if they give you a problem that you weren't expecting, like a customer having a heart attack in the cabin? And then all of a sudden, all of these other competencies come into play. But most, certainly what I thought as a military pilot was, this is all about flying the aeroplane. I can do this. But actually, no. We know it's not. And only two of the nine pilot competencies are anything to do with actually flying the aeroplane, manual flight control and use of automation. The rest of the pilot competencies are non-technical skills. And it's how those skills are, again, how you provide proof you have strength in all those different competencies that will mean you'll pass the simulator assessment. So really, this proof that you have strength in all of these different competency areas is the key to a successful assessment, to summarize that.
Yeah, that's right. And especially when you have a look at the all the companies that hire people, and especially pilots, they do not mandatorily have a simulator assessment. I mean, I passed a couple of interviews. So I can mention them now because I don't work for them. EasyJet or for Cathay Dragon, that is not anymore Cathay Dragon, that is that has been shut down. CityJet, I am sure you know this this company,
yeah.
Irish company. And for Porter in Canada, and for two other companies I can't mention. And all those companies, only two were requesting a simulator assessment, EasyJet and Cathay Dragon. The other one, the interview process was only based on behavioral questions and how you can adapt to a situation and how you see yourself. Psychological question, of course, some psychometrics initially. I don't recall the name of the psychometrics we have to do online, especially for EasyJet. Cathay Dragon was the same. Porter, we didn't have to do any of that. And yeah, it's mainly based on a behavioral question, how you are on a flight deck. And that is very important because I think that they are looking for good pilots, obviously, but the most important thing is that they are looking for teammates, and teammates that are able to communicate efficiently, communicate calmly to your captain if you are hired as a first officer, or to the cabin crew, the flight attendants that are not pilots, and you have to know how to communicate to them.
Absolutely. And for any military pilots, I am making an assumption here, Matthew, but I'm going to assume that you do use the same pilot competencies, the ones that EASA also outlines. So things like leadership and teamwork and workload management. And if you are a military pilot and you've not heard of the pilot competencies before, then there are a set of qualities or areas of strength that lead to a safe operation in both normal and non-normal situations. And as you've just correctly identified, it's mostly about the non-technical skills. So, for example, if we look at something like workload management, how do you manage that workload? Are you able to maintain self-control in a certain situation? Are you able to prioritize tasks effectively? Do you offer assistance to your colleague? Do you accept assistance when you need it? Do you verify that all of the things you should have done have been done? So this is all part of workload management. And in a simulator assessment, that could be assessed. But actually, I could ask you some interview questions in that area. I could also put you in a group assessment and see how you manage your workload when I give the group a complex task to resolve. And whether it's answering an interview question or demonstrating it in practice in a group assessment or a simulator assessment, they are all the bits of evidence that they're looking for, these little pointers in all these different areas. And it's quite complex, isn't it? When you start combining all of these things, you go, well, if my situational awareness is high, then I'm likely to manage a spike in my workload. So how do I build my situational awareness? Well, through effective communication is one thing. So how do I effectively communicate? Well, I have to ask open and interactive questions and actively listen and check understanding. And then, of course, all of these competencies start to meld into one. And that's exactly what the recruitment teams are assessing, as their strength in all of these different competency areas.
And how am I capable, especially how can I communicate to someone that is not available right now? How to check the availability of someone? Because you don't want to, asking for situational awareness, you don't want to distract situational awareness of your teammate. And you have to have this kind of situational awareness and situational intelligence to know when ask questions, how ask questions, and according to the saturation level of your teammate, how to interact with him.
Absolutely. And actually, that particular thing you've spoken about there is one bit of evidence, one little bit of proof or a pointer at effective communication as a competency, ensuring that the recipient, in this case, your colleague, is ready and able to receive that information. Because if they're not, they're not going to hear what you're saying. Therefore, that's not going to help build situational awareness as a crew. So you're absolutely right. And, you know, you can provide that proof in an interview answer. They might give you a fake scenario and say, what would you do if you were on the approach and the captain started deviating away from the planned brief. So you're hearing this question, they're giving you a fictitious scenario, and it's up to you to identify which competency is likely to be an important one when answering that question. So in my mind, one of the big competencies is going to be communication skills. Am I able to, you know, use my intervention model and appropriately intervene, maybe hint and tip at what might be wrong? You know, hey, how do you think the approach is going? And then maybe start to elevate that and say, well, listen, you know, Matthew, you said we were going to do this during the briefing. We don't appear to be doing that. So we might be a bit high at that next waypoint. And then elevating it again. Matthew, you must listen. This isn't what we brief. This is going to become unsafe and I don't feel comfortable continuing. To the point where, Matthew, go around. And in an interview answer, you can provide that sort of intervention model, which is really evidencing your ability to communicate clearly and calmly and confidently and influence people, which are all bits of evidence I'd like to see. But of course, if I put you in a simulator and that sort of thing happens, then I'd expect to see you do those things in practical ways. So I'd be observing that evidence rather than just hearing it in an interview. But it all comes back to what are the little pointers, the little bits of evidence that I can provide this recruitment team with to prove that I have strength in those areas. And if you do that successfully, you'll pass your assessment.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know if you can say that in English, but it's kind of an escalating answer. Not escalating answer, but escalating, you know, questions. Just initially try to guide the person, try to ask to the person a good question, you know, and then a question that is a little bit more, let's say, sensitive, and then you dig deeper and deeper, and then you just say, okay, now we have to stop the approach, as you said. And this is the advanced recruitment process. Backing up a little bit, I had the opportunity to be able to have kind of assessment program back in the French Air Force in 2019, helping to, you know, write my resume, to present myself, to be able to talk about myself non-technical during a technical interview. And I think it helped me a lot, especially the resume part. And, you know, the individual interview, because you have to know how, because first of all, the resume is the first stage of the process. This is the first thing that the recruiters gonna see about you. They're gonna look at your resume, they're gonna read it. And if the resume is not attractive enough, they will not invite you to the next stage. And in my opinion, this is the first and the basic stuff to work. And then comes the individual interview, and then comes the group interview.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, the resume, in the UK we call it the CV, is the only thing that you have 100% control over. And alongside Flight Deck Wingman, I also co-direct a small pilot recruitment agency called Sky Chaser. And when we receive resumes, they're often really, really terrible. They've not been constructed well. They're not visually impactful. They've clearly not been aligned to the opportunity that they're applying for. I can't check whether the pilot's credentials match the credentials of the job opportunity. So I'm looking at the CV and I'm like, well, quite honestly, I don't have time for this. So that unless there's something that really stands out, and I've got hundreds of other CVs to look at, well, that CV is probably going to go in the bin. You know, yeah,
my first resume was terrible, man.
All of us are. But this is why you need a bit of guidance. And, you know, I'd say probably 90% of resumes I see are really bad, really bad. But it doesn't take much to actually tweak it. I'm not saying you have to start from fresh for every opportunity, but what I'd really encourage your listeners to do is if they are applying for a specific opportunity, to think, right, what can I do to tailor this CV to this specific opportunity? Because it's going to make a real difference to when the recruiter sees it. And, you know, it takes a lot of effort to put a good application together. But it's a bit like being a sports person as well, I guess. They're all incremental gains. If your CV is good, your resume is good, then, you know, you're more likely to get to the interview. If you get to the interview and that interview performance is good and it's backed up by a good CV, then, you know, you're more likely to get to the next stage. They're all little incremental gains that you can make. And it's really important. And that's where it comes back to most candidates are very badly prepared for assessment processes.
Yeah, as you say, the resume is the first step. Then comes the individual interview, then the group interview, then the simulatory assessment. I never prepared a lot about the simulatory assessment, to be very honest. I only, you know, had some ideas about previous colleagues that went to take the assessment, especially the EasyJet one, because I had some colleagues that took the simulatory assessment in EasyJet. Cathay Dragon, I only had a look on a couple of forums. What would be your advice regarding that phase of the recruitment?
For the simulator phase, every airline that we're aware of that's recruiting pilots at the moment is either fully invested or rapidly accelerating toward what they call EBT. Certainly in the UK, that stands for evidence-based training and assessment. And if you think about it, you've been in the airline world a little bit less time than me, but certainly when I started back in the 2006-07 time, we got into the simulator and we'd know that we were going to have an engine failure. Then we'd know we'd do a non-precision approach. Then we'd know it'd be followed by several things. And simulator assessments were very similar. It was like, let's see if this pilot can fly an ILS. Let's see if this pilot can fly a holding pattern. But as time has gone on, and with events like, you know, Sullenberger on the Hudson River, you know, I guarantee you they'd never practice a double engine failure from a goose strike and landing on a river in the middle of a city. And the things that made that outcome a successful one was the use of the non-technical pilot competencies with some of the technical stuff, but majority non-technical: workload management, situational awareness, effective leadership and teamwork, communication skills. All of these competencies came together to enable them to land the aircraft safely on the river in a very high workload situation. So the airlines are now moving, if not fully involved in evidence-based training and assessment. They are assessing your pilot competencies, and they're looking for evidence, this proof that you have strength in these various pilot competencies. So it follows that simulator assessments, recruitment processes, are also following this evidence-based training and assessment, and they're looking for this proof, this evidence that you have strength in the pilot competencies. So I think increasingly we're going to see simulator assessments moving away from your ability to just fly the aeroplane smoothly and accurately, which is part of manual flight control, and start to look more at your leadership and teamwork, your communication skills, your situational awareness, your workload management, and they will introduce scenarios to give you the opportunity to provide them with that evidence or not. And if you don't, you won't pass a sim assessment. And it's for very good reason. You know, it's, you and I would have prided ourselves on our manual flight, flying fast jets. You know, that's what we did, and doing it very accurately and being on it. But, you know, I probably do 5 minutes of flying on a 14-hour flight these days. The rest of the time is spent in the non-technical competency areas.
So we know that your company, Flight Deck Winman, so you have a first job that is being an airline pilot, a Boeing 787 pilot. You have a second job that is to help preparing for the assessments, for the airline assessments, only the airline, right?
Well, interesting, majority airline, but we've helped people with, you know, applying to helicopter companies, for example, for simulator jobs, you know, instructional jobs, corporate flying. So actually, Flight Deck Wingman helps pilots applying to all sorts of opportunities. And now joined by another product called Flight School Wingman, which helps future pilots. So those people wanting to become either an airline pilot or wanting to become a military pilot. So the two brands now complement each other, with Flight Deck Wingman being for qualified pilots, whether that's military, current airline pilots, or just recently qualified pilots. And we've got Flight School Wingman, which is for those that don't have a license, maybe done no flying ever, and they're just wanting to become a pilot. And, you know, what an exciting time for them. But we're now happy to offer that product as well.
And you still have your podcast?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, for Flying Out Loud. I mean, it's, as you might imagine, it's so busy with airline recruitment right now that I infrequently get to record them. But yeah, for Flying Out Loud, it's got a good listenership, you know, but I really need to push out more episodes. And I've got a list of guests as long as my arm. And I need to get you on there as well, Matthew, to talk about flying a Rafale and your transition. But yeah, it's time, mate. You know, so it's. But I love the podcast. It's so nice chatting to people and getting to know their stories and, you know, any difficulties they've had in their lives. And some of them are really inspirational people, you know, that I feel really privileged to talk to.
Yeah, having a podcast is very time consuming. I mean, from the recording, scheduling the recording, that is not very easy, especially when you want to interview pilots that have a tight schedule, you know what it is. So scheduling the recording, then post-production, because I guess that you are alone running this show. It's not very easy to be able to put that activity in your schedule, and especially in your airline pilot schedule.
Well, yeah, exactly. In terms of the recording stuff, and you know, some guests take a lot of time to research. So, you know, I recently interviewed, who was the coolest one recently? The Jet Seat Man. I don't know if you've seen Gravity Industries, and Richard Browning is the guy that straps the little jet engines to his arms and his back and flies around. But you know, with those sorts of guests, they're extremely busy, and you want to make sure that you're, you know, giving them the proper airtime. So you have to go away and research them, read their book, think about some structure to the pod, and then you've got to get them together. Then, as you know, record it. I'm lucky enough to have a friend called Rory, who's an ex BBC sound man that helps edit the sound down for me and all my little intro and things. So that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But I love it. Yeah, like you do. You know, I love doing the pods. And actually, if I could free up a bit more time, I'd do them full time, actually. But yeah.
Great. So all the listeners can check on your podcast out for Flying Out Loud.
That's right. It. Yeah, for Flying Out Loud. Yeah, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Yeah, on all the podcast platforms for Flying Out Loud. They can check on your new website. You talked about it.
Yeah, flightdeckwingman.com and flightschoolwingman.com for newly qualified pilots. They're the two places to go. And there's a lot of free knowledge-based stuff on there. So at flightdeckwingman.com, they can click on latest posts. There's free knowledge-based, free articles to help people and a whole range of stuff to help people with different services if they want it. But I'm not here to push that too hard, Matthew. I appreciate you having me on here. But take a look and get in touch with us if you've got any questions.
Yeah, no worries. We talked about a lot about transitioning from the military to the civilian aviation, about you know, how to prepare yourself about the assessment. So that's normal, especially having a dual professional, a first of all professional pilot and professional airline assessment specialist. That's great to be able to talk about it. And it's a subject that I like, because I think it's important to talk about it, and it's important to be prepared to that kind of assessment. So thank you very much for talking about it. Perhaps I see you around flying in Canada. I know that you flew in Vancouver recently, no?
Yeah, no. Well, I was on my holidays to Halifax in Nova Scotia, where some of my wife's family are, and yeah, we had a great time out there. It's a wild place, but I was eyeing up this lake and thinking, could I get a float plane in there? You know, I'm a big sort of general aviation enthusiast as well. So if I'm getting to, you know, a small light aircraft and go flying, then I will, particularly gliding. But now I'm thinking, you know, retirement in 20 years, can I somehow get a float plane together and go out to Canada and fly around the Canadian lakes? That'd be awesome. That's something I really want to do.
Great. So see you around perhaps next time. And thanks a lot, Andrew.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Thanks, Matthew. And we'll catch up again soon.
Ciao.